Welcome to our podcast, Sounding Off with Kim Munson. I am thrilled to have on the line with me former state senator Kevin Lundberg. He is the author of the Lundberg Report. Kevin Lundberg, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks. It's great being with you, Kim.
We have quite a bit going on here in Colorado, and your most recent newsletter, you talk about the session ends soon, but it has not been soon enough, but it has been a very ugly legislative session. So what's going on down at the State House?
Well, quite fortunately, not quite as much now as a few days ago when the session was still on. But, I called the session weird because it had so many strange components to it. Let me back you up just a little bit. This General Assembly has been meeting for 2 years now, right after the 2018 election. And last year, they pushed through the most liberal agenda in the 120-day session that we have ever seen. And it just went across the board with, there was the sex ed bill, there was the oil and gas regulation bill, there were so many bills empowering the health department, CDPHE, to have more authority and power in so many areas. So that's what happened last year. So this year, we seemed to have kind of the same setup when we entered into the session in January, with a lot of really heavy-handed government regulation bills pushing radical agendas. And we were kind of buckling down for more of the same of what we saw last year, which had started to come. But then we had the pandemic issue, and the legislature stopped meeting. Then they relied on a rule that had been put in place about a dozen years ago that said, in the case of a medical pandemic or medical epidemic, the legislature can actually take some time off from their 120-day schedule and not have to wrap up in mid-May. It went to the Colorado Supreme Court, and by a very tight 4-3 decision, they upheld that rule. And so weeks after they had let off, they came back together. But they were under new rules, because when you take that time off, you're supposed to only deal with the, quote, mission critical issues before the legislature. That means the budget, the School Finance Act, issues relating to the epidemic, and, you know, just basic stuff that has to get done. But everything else was to be put aside. And so they did, to some degree, but not entirely. They just couldn't resist to put some bills, like here's one. Senate Bill 166 allows minors to change their birth certificate gender. And that has nothing to do with the epidemic, but somehow they just had to push that one through as well. And that's just one example of many that occurred. We also saw the legislature now having to deal with this economic disaster. And instead of them stepping up to the plate and saying, well, you know, small businesses and individuals have really been hurt through all this, so let's see what we can do to really reinvigorate the private industry. No, they just sort of cast that aside, and they stole every amount of cash fund they could to keep the budget afloat. And to keep every program and project going as fast as possible. Now, they talked about a huge, huge $3 billion shortfall, which actually is over the next two fiscal years of revenue projections. But when you look at everything they did, they really didn't get rid of anything. They just pulled it back barely. And if you compare the budget they prepared to the one that was 2 years ago, it's actually bigger.
Really?
Go around. Yeah, it's because they've been growing everything as fast as possible, and it's actually just a very small retrenchment from last year's budget. And then on top of that, the governor gets about $1 billion that comes from the federal government, and instead of going to the legislature and saying, let's figure out how to spend this, he just does it by executive order. Even though the legislature, when he actually issued the order, the Joint Budget Committee was back meeting determining what the budget is, so it would have been most logical for the governor to step in and say, okay, we've got this $1 billion. I'd like you to put it in the budget in this way and that way. He basically gives $500 million to higher ed and $500 million to K through 12 education, and pretty much leaves everything else out. Gives the legislature a whopping $70 million of this $2 billion package to actually appropriate. But that's why I call it weird. It's just like every rule was thrown out the window, and they just started making this stuff up. Oh, and let me give you one other element. While the session, while the assembly was away on this extended recess, the president of the Senate banned all senators from going onto the Senate floor. I think that was an action that he should have been removed from the Senate over. But, of course, they all supported him in his party, and that's all it took. But just so many weird things were occurring this year, and they seemed to break every rule in the book. And as a former legislator, I was just aghast at how it was managed.
Kevin, I want to go back to something you mentioned early on, and that was that there had been legislation that had been passed a number of years ago that would, you know, allow for this adjournment in the case of a medical emergency or pandemic. Was that specific to that, or were there other things as well, or was this piece of legislation just addressing that?
Well, let me, legislation usually refers to a bill. This was a resolution, which is something we legislate, yes. But yeah, it's called Joint Rule 44. You see, the House and the Senate are charged by the Constitution to set up rules for how they operate. And so there are House rules, there are Senate rules, and in some cases, there are what are called joint rules, where they both agree, okay, for this situation, this is what we're going to do. Now, I was in the legislature back then, and this was shortly after the H1N1 bug had been flying around, and people thought this might be the big pandemic bug, which it wasn't. But it did get everybody to thinking really hard on what do we do if we really did have a medical emergency like this. And there was a lot of study done by some interim committees back then, and they came up with this Joint Rule 44. Now, the Supreme Court, when they looked at it, they said, well, you know, the legislature adopted this unanimously, sort of, kind of. It's because it was put into the proposed rules for the House and the Senate for that year, and then it's been perfunctorily adopted every year. Every year that you go into a session, you adopt rules to operate by, and you simply accept the rules that were there last year. So this rule was folded in, really very little debate nor discussion, and frankly, I didn't even remember we had done it. But when I think back and I talk to some of my colleagues, I kind of, you know, pieced it back together. So we put this rule together, and it's actually a fairly extensive a document where it specifies exactly what you're supposed to do. And that's where I think they relied on the rule in order to extend things, but they didn't follow the rule very carefully, because when that occurs, it's supposed to be such an extraordinary circumstance that the legislature only deals with, again, the term is mission critical legislation. But it was designed for essentially this type of circumstance.
Okay. And thanks for clarifying, because I'm like, what was going on? But I guess it does make sense that somebody would have brought up that conversation regarding the H1N1, but you said that they followed part of the rule and obviously not part of the rule. But
yeah, well, they used the rule rather than followed the rules the way I was
putting
it.
Okay.
And actually, let me give you this one other element, because I remember back then I actually did attend a conference on what do you do if a pandemic happens. It was sponsored through the American Legislative Exchange Council. I was on the health committees back then, and it was a fairly exclusive group, really. A conference for, you know, health committee members, and there were maybe 30 or 40 of us from around the nation, and we listened to the experts who said, okay, this is what could happen. And the final analysis, I do recall this, they said, you know, we kind of know the dynamics of what a pandemic means, but nobody's going to take it seriously, nor really prepare for it until it does happen. And, yeah, within that environment, that's where that rule came out of. But in reality, my impression in talking to the experts back then in, I don't know, it was like 2009 or so, is these are uncharted waters, and we really won't know what it's like until we get there. And now we see, sort of.
Sort of. Well, true.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your Lundberg letter that goes out once a week. And you said in this that we actually were able to dodge some bad ideas. I mean, there seemed like there was a lot of bad stuff that came out of this legislative session. But what were some of the bad ideas that we dodged?
Well, a couple of bills that we saw early on. Let's see, one was a House bill. 1008 was the number, and it was concerning medical cost-sharing programs, which is an alternative to medical insurance that thousands of people in Colorado take advantage of, and because it really isn't insurance, it's just a group that agrees to pay each other's medical bills, and this has been going on for many years, and it's well-established practice. Well, anyway, this bill would have put heavy, heavy regulations on medical cost-sharing programs, and it was just flying through the process. That one, they didn't move forward with, so that one died. There was another one, let's see, Senate Bill 156, I believe, was the number, and it set up a whole list, a big laundry list, of mandates for medical insurance programs to follow, you know, a whole lot of testing procedures that had to be provided to anybody who had medical insurance before any deductibles or copays. So these are, you know, extras you added on, and a lot of them are little simple things of, you know, testing for this disease or that disease, which didn't have a lot of consequence, except it does all add up to mean insurance is going to be that much more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get down to the end of this bill, and it deals with quote family planning services, and it essentially says anybody who goes to any provider for quote family planning services, your insurance company will pay everything. And it went so far as to say, and it doesn't have to be in any network. No, if you go to a family planning service and receive any service or any related service out of that, that your insurance company is to pay for that. And then it says if there's any complication from any of those procedures from that family planning service, that that your insurance company, again, is to pay for it above, before any deductibles or copays, so they're to pay the entire bill, whether it's in-network or out-of-network. And I looked at that, and I said, man, this is a blank check. And it even exempts the family planning service from any liability because it instructs the insurance company to pay for all complications. I mean, it was just a blank check to somebody. Now, you got to say, okay, who provides, quote, family planning services in the state of Colorado? I know, Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really are the big provider of that structure, whatever, you know, I mean. And so this was a blank check to Planned Parenthood, and it was flying through the system, but it didn't look like that. You had to dig through the bill to find those last few paragraphs that described all that. Well, that one, finally, just a few days before the session was over, was laid over till August 1st, which, since they went sunny-die here in June, that bill died. And so that's another one that died. And then there were, I don't remember a lot of them, but there were a lot of bills that were just not a very good idea that I put on my, I compiled about, I don't know, initially I think it was like 30 really bad bills that I saw, and I missed some. You know, there were a lot of them that I didn't get to. But some of those they realized they didn't have the time to deal with it, and so they did kill those. And for that, I'm very grateful. We dodged a lot of bullets that if we don't change the legislature in this next election, we're going to see those bills back next year, and they're going to fly through the system just like they started to this year.
Let's talk just a little bit about Planned Parenthood then, because I'm trying to find it right now. And, you know, you think that you have that you can search the internet and get all kinds of information, but some of the information you want to get doesn't come up as quickly as you would like. But right. Planned Parenthood, I think the most recent number I remember is that they received about $500 million in funding from the federal government. And I'm not getting the source on that immediately. But also then, I remember a headline where they were going to contribute millions of dollars in this election cycle to primarily Democrat candidates. So let's just think about how this works. So Planned Parenthood is funded, a whole lot of it, by taxpayer money. So money that's taken from hardworking people, these businesses that have been closed down. You know, it looks like this Colorado legislature wants more of their money. But so they take that via force. They say you have to pay your taxes. And I think we all agree there's probably some portion of taxes that need to be paid, but it needs to be pretty limited and for certain, you know, certain things. But so anyway, they take our money, and then this particular piece of proposed legislation would have basically given a blank check to them, and then they turn around and they use that money in elections. There's something that's really wrong about this picture, Kevin Lundberg.
There's something very predictable about this picture as well, because that's what's special interest that figure out how to work the system end up operating, you know, and they make sure that legislation is put in place that favors them, and then they certainly make sure that the people that are going to vote for their issues they favor when the election rolls around. Yeah, there's a perverse system at work here, and I'm not proposing that we create a whole lot of legislation to, you know, to try to, quote, control campaign finance, because then they game that system, too.
Well, I agree.
You know, let me give you an example. This is a big one that was put in place here in Colorado about 20 years ago, and that is they created a mechanism called the Small Donor Committee in campaign finance laws here in Colorado. Sounds rather innocuous. Small donor committee, okay, mm-hmm. You know, got small donors, what's the big deal? Well, it was actually a sweetheart deal for unions, because a small donor committee simply means that any one individual can contribute no more than $50 per year to such a committee. But then the committee has the ability to turn around and give over 10 times as much to any individual candidate as any other individual or political committee can do. So a legislator who can only collect a maximum of $400 per election cycle from any other PAC can get over $4,000 from a small donor committee. And unions are uniquely set up to collect a few dollars from every member, and the members don't even, you know, really realize it's happening. It's just part of union dues. And then the union just develops this huge, huge war chest that they use in promoting their candidates. So, you know, if you say, well, we've got to fix this with campaign finance, well, I don't know about that. I think we need to do it with transparency and accountability and doing what we're doing right now to point out that this can happen. And yeah, Senate Bill 156 that gave such a sweetheart deal to Planned Parenthood was written and voted for those office holders who were supported by Planned Parenthood. People need to realize that happens, and it happens among big utilities. Frankly, they have a nifty way to encourage people to vote their way. You know, any big entity that has a lot of political savvy works the game like that.
Well, you know, Kevin Lumberg, and you were down at the State House for a number of years, and really the people that are elected are supposed to be representatives of the people, you know, the hardworking people out there paying taxes. But it seems like the little guy is really the one that's in the frying pan whenever this legislature meets. And so your point that we really, you know, elections really have consequences, and the veil is off on these people that have claimed that they care about people so that they can do another government program. But through this whole COVID-19, Wuhan virus, reaction, disruption, we realize that they don't really care about people. And so I think it's an opportunity, because now the veil is off. Those that said they care about people, we're realizing they don't really.
Oh, yeah. They answer to the folks who put them there. And that's deeply disappointing. But, you know, we as individual citizens need to know this and recognize it. And when you go to the voting booth, you've got to ask yourself, who's there for me and who's there for the system? And this last session has really shown it clearly because, you know, as I say, the legislation that they pushed through and they considered mission critical were issues that special interests were promoting. And the biggest special interest, and I had learned this very early on as a legislator, the biggest special interest is, you know, what I call the state party, which you've got the Republicans that are more limited government, you've got the Democrats that are a whole lot more big government, but there's also this big, big political system out there that just supports the government system, you know, and that's what we saw reflected in the budget process this year. They didn't shut down programs. They empowered them. They didn't trim back any, you know, like a lot of private businesses in this economic depression, really. I trust it's short-lived. I don't know. But they've had to literally cut the salaries of some of their people. Did we consider that in the legislature? No, not at all. Didn't even consider really tightening the belt much, a little bit, a very little bit, by telling departments that you're going to not see your budget grow as much this year as you did last year. But the whole focus was just to keep the system going. And as, you know, I'm a Republican because I believe that there are more people within the ranks of the Republicans, both as voting citizens and as elected officials, that really do want to look after our freedoms and our rights and privileges as citizens, rather than grow this big socialist, you know, machine that we all would then have to answer to every day in our life.
Well, I think that segues into the next subject that you had in the Lundberg letter this last week, and that was Senate Bill 163. And again, the veil is off. I have been astonished that it has been across the political spectrum of people looking at this legislation and saying, you know what, this is a big potential overreach by government. And I think a lot of people are waking up. I've heard, particularly just on this bill, that there have been Democrats that have said, I will not vote Democrat because of this. So I know that you testified down there regarding the Senate Bill 163. So set that up a little bit for our listeners.
Well, okay, 163 had to do with parents taking an exemption for their children when it comes to vaccinations. And that doesn't mean just if a parent says, no, I don't want any vaccinations anywhere. Could be that they just don't want one or two that they, you know, they either saw their child react to in some way that they were concerned over, or they just thought that it needed to be on a slower pace than what the health department calls for. Here's the bottom line, and that is, who should be in charge of the medical care of your children, you or the government? And 163 made it much more difficult for parents to take a medical or a personal exemption for vaccinations for their kids. And it actually sets up a much higher standard because health department makes it, you know, if you want a personal exemption for your kids for vaccines, you have to sit through, now according to 163, you'll have to sit through a re-education program, either from your doctor or from the health department, in order to get this little certificate that says, I can now take a personal exemption. Prior to 163, a parent just had to sign a statement that says, I'm personally opposed to this. My child will not be participating. Thank you. Anyway, so that's essentially what the bill was all about. And just a slight bit of history, I've been in this battle ever since I was started in the legislature in 2003. And back then, it was just a handful of us who said, you know, parents need to have the authority here, not the state. And I mean, you know, I can give you several chapters in this fight we've had. But a couple of years ago, citizens started to figure this out. And you're right, across the political spectrum. They just knew that when it comes to their kids, they should be in charge rather than the government. And this was a big, heavy-handed ploy on the part of the government to push through their agenda. Now, let me add one final thing to this. 163 is, they pushed, well, thousands of people showed up. When I testified, that was, actually it was extraordinary because the committee meeting was on a Sunday afternoon, which I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. And a couple thousand people had gathered outside the building in opposition to 163. Of course, they only let a handful of us into the room. Here's an interesting, strange political bedfellow is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Understands this as well, and he flew out from, you know, I guess he lives in somewhere in the East Coast, to testify against the bill. So he was there. Michelle Malkin, who many people know quite well, was testifying against it, and myself and a few others. And so despite all of this opposition, they just plowed right through. Now, they did realize that there's some real political concern out there, and the sponsor kept insisting this only affects kids in public or private schools, not homeschools. Well, it really did affect everybody, but at the very end, they did, under a lot of pressure from I want to say, to the credit of the Republican caucus, they pushed them on this, and so they got an amendment in there that says if you are homeschooling your kids, you don't have to abide by all these heavy-handed rules. Now, they're going to find a way around that, but nonetheless, that's what they put in the bill. So that's 163, and prior to the pandemic, thousands of people came and hundreds came saying, I want to testify. Well, the chairman only allowed 90 minutes of testimony, and even those of us who were scheduled just barely got in. As a matter of fact, when they called my name, we only had a few minutes left for testimony, and they kind of looked around and they were about ready to pull me back, but finally I was able to get up and give a little more information on why this bill was a bad idea and why the process was a bad idea too. I'll add this one little element, and That is that I was so disgusted with how the chairman, that was Representative Lahntin, was handling this committee meeting that I had to tell her, hey, I was in your shoes in the Senate. I was chairman for 2 years, and this is not acceptable protocol. You are not doing a good job as chairman. And anyway, then I moved on to point out that it was a bad bill, and the health department shouldn't be trusted in this. The parents should be.
Totally agree on that. And as you mentioned, it's across the spectrum that was opposed to this. Now, this is becoming law, though. Is that correct, Senate Bill 163?
I'm sure the governor will sign it. So, yes, it was passed. It had that one amendment for homeschool families that gives a little bit of relief, but not a lot. But, yeah, it's due for signature from the governor, and I'm sure he'll give it to him.
Okay, so Kevin Lundberg, we got just a few minutes left. We can talk about the next issue that you had on your Lundberg letter, or is there just something that you want to make sure that people know, have a certain takeaway after they listen to this podcast?
Yeah, there's something I would like everybody to realize, and that is that the whole political expectations have been shaken up through this epidemic and this crisis that I think has been somewhat constructed by some of the powers that be as well. But my takeaway on what we've been discussing is I don't think this election that we will have in November will be anything like anybody expects. As I've told a lot of people, I think it's going to be a landslide. I just don't know which direction. And I mean that because, you know, you mentioned with 163 that it just struck across the political spectrum. Well, I'm not sure people really know what political brand they're with anymore. The Democrats have gone so, really, dare I say it, lunatic extreme on so many issues, you know, calling for literally taking the police forces out of existence. And is there room for some reform? Absolutely. But you know, we've just seen so many dramatic changes that people need to really focus in on the election coming up in November, because that will set that will determine the course of this nation and this state and in many ways our world. I believe if you sit on the sidelines and just watch, shame on you, because you've got to get engaged like never before. And I don't care who you are, you have a responsibility to ensure that this nation prevails as the land of the free, because our basic rights are in jeopardy, and are really, I see a lot of the policies are threatening our freedoms and our prosperity, and those two really go together. You really can't have the prosperity without the freedom, and the freedom won't be able to survive if you can't economically thrive.
And Maggie Thatcher, said that as well. So, okay, Kevin Lundberg, that busy person out there. I remember before this whole, you know, COVID-19, Wuhan virus reaction disruption, I talked to people and, you know, they're like, oh, there's not that much difference between Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, we have a big swath that I think's been unhappy with both of the parties. And so we've got a whole bunch of independents. And, but they say, you know, I'm not really into politics. And I'm like, well, politics is into you. But people weren't feeling it because we were, you know, quote unquote, we were fat and happy. I mean, the economy was doing well. And, you know, I think somebody said that they realized that during the Wuhan virus, reaction disruption, is that they realized that one of their main hobbies was they loved to go to restaurants and bars and taverns and meet their friends. And they realized that they couldn't anymore. But all of a sudden now, people are paying attention and they're confused. And I think that that's by design. They're like, how could I get the truth? How, you say we need to be engaged. How can people find out things? Of course, my recommendation is to listen to my show and podcast and to read the Lundberg letter. That's a couple of good places to start. But okay, so busy person, they come to you. You say you need to be engaged. What should they do?
First, they should figure out who's running for office. And we're right in the final days of the primary, so it's going to boil down to who the Republican candidate is and who the Democrat candidate is. And any other candidate, frankly, is just going to be a throwaway vote. Be aware of that. So figure out who's running in your area. Maybe you're happy with who it is, and they're not seriously challenged. Well, go get engaged in another race, you know, in a neighboring district or maybe at a statewide level. Or the really big question is the presidency. Now, you need to figure out how you can be effective. You know, literally, identify that candidate and then call them up and say, what can I do to help you? You know, for sure, make sure they have the funds, but make sure they have the people, the friends, first and foremost. Get engaged, get educated, get involved. Don't sit on your hands. And I see one of the agendas that's being, you know, pushed in all of this is to lock everybody up in their home and distract them so they don't realize what's happening to them long-term politically. But this election is the, you know, you might say the final shot we've got at preserving our future. And yeah. It's going to take everything. You've got to stay educated, and you've got to stay involved, and you've got to figure out how can I make my effort really count to make it happen. And that's why I think it's going to be a landslide, one direction or the other. Yeah, it's up to us as to which direction that's going to be pushed.
And that landslide, the real questions that will be on the table is the tussle between two ideologies. And the ideology Absolutely. Is one of uniting us and creating and people thriving and prospering. The other ideology you see playing out on the streets of Seattle. You see it when I was downtown a few weeks ago. You see that ideology played out with boarded up windows at our beautiful Brown Palace Hotel with broken windows. So it's an ideology of uniting, coming together to unite, of freedom, of justice, of, you know, our American, you know, idea, or one of destruction and tearing people down and dividing them. I see it as those are the two ideologies. And just a quick note, I'm not sure if you know this, Kevin Lundberg, but my researcher, Patty, connected the dots, and now I'm starting to see it in some of the national news. But if you go to Black Lives Matter's website and you click donate, the money goes to Act Blue, which is the big Democrat fundraising machine. And yeah. We agree you can't even say that now today. It seems like that every life matters. And there are, you know, every profession has some bad apples, and what happened up in Minneapolis, we are united in our concern that happened. We are united there. But then what we've seen is the Democrat Party has taken that, and they are trying to divide us, and we're seeing the destruction of the American idea. We're seeing the destruction of our neighborhoods and our communities. So I see that as the two questions, and it's out there. You can see it, that this destruction is being funded by the Democrat Party. So your final thought on this, Kevin Lundberg?
Well, it goes back to what we've been talking about. You've got to connect with the people that represent you in government. And you know, final thought here is, let's say you are happy with who's running. Well, connect with them and make sure that they know that you know that this is a really big deal, because sometimes they don't even get it. And so, yeah, I mean, Kim, I could not agree with you more that this is a very, very important time for all of us. In our generation, this is the challenge we have. And, you know, the history books will reflect whether we failed or we succeeded. And I believe there's prospect for both.
Well, and you know what? I want to make sure that I'm in the game on this. And I know that you are as well. And because, you know, I've interviewed over 130 World War II veterans for my America's Veterans Story show. And, you know, they stepped up at their time to stand against tyranny and despotism. And ours is, it looks different, but it's the same old thing. And it is our time, Kevin Lundberg. So, Kevin Lundberg, thank you so much. And how can people get your Lundberg letter?
Well, you go to my website, which is kevinlundberg.com, and click on it's free, it's weekly. We don't spam you with other things. We just send you the information in as concise a form as possible.
I know you put a lot of work in that, and it is a very valuable tool to understand what's going on. So, Kevin Lundberg, thank you so much for joining me with Sounding Off with Kim Munson. God bless you, and God bless America.